It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, last night voters in Houston rejected an anti-discrimination ordinance that would have protected LGBT people and several other groups. We'll talk to a political scientist about the vote and what it means for the anti-discrimination efforts nationwide. First, Republicans have a new House Speaker in Paul Ryan, but the next possible government shutdown looms just over a month away. It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Also, in those elections yesterday, one of the main races being watched was governor of Kentucky. Polls showed tight race. In the end, a big margin for the Republicans. So is there something wrong with the state of polling? And media bias has been a big topic in the wake of last week's CNBC Republican presidential debate. Harry is here to talk about it all and more. Harry, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's start in Kentucky. Polls, close race, Republican wins by a pretty huge margin. Should we give up on this whole idea of political polling, Harry?
Well, you know, I quit my job earlier today.
Well done.
No, this is just an example of we had only three polls that came out over the final 3 weeks of that campaign. The Democratic candidate, Jack Conway, was polling at about 45-44%, depending on which poll you looked at. And Kentucky's a state that's becoming more and more Republican on the national level. And so if you just look at the polling from that race, you don't just look at the governor's race, but all the rest of them, it seems that pretty much all of the undecided went towards the Republican candidates up and down the ballot, which isn't too shocking, given that it's Kentucky, a state that Mitt Romney carried by 23 points. I should also point out, in Mississippi, the polling was actually pretty good, but nobody likes to talk about when the polling's right, only when it's wrong.
Well, yeah, and generally polls, especially on bigger races, higher turnout races, generally pretty solid.
Right. So, you know, this is a type of thing that I'm not too worried about, you know, for the 2016 general election. You know, most voters turn out in those elections versus these off-year races where it's much more difficult to know who's going to turn out. And you have to have some sort of turnout model. So it's possible that the turnout model that the pollsters are using in Kentucky simply included too many Democrats in it. But next year in the primaries, we'll see. Maybe they might include too many people who won't actually vote, and that's something to keep an eye on. But for the general election, as we're looking to, I'm guessing Hillary Clinton versus whomever the Republicans nominate, I'm not too worried about a polling miscue there. But in the primaries, it could be a big deal.
Is it a problem in off years? This is not a big election year, obviously, so you don't have a lot of national polling groups out in the field who might have done, you know, the presidential race in Kentucky. And, oh, there's a governor's race. We'll poll on that, too. So you have a smaller sample of polls to work with.
Yeah, you have a much smaller sample. So, you know, if you look at a lot of the races, you know, in 2014 where, the you know, Republicans were again underestimated, but usually there was at least one or two polls that got the result right. In Kentucky, we just had so few polls to go off of that when I looked at the race on Monday, I think the best you could say was, hey, the polls show that Jack Conway, the Democrats, ahead, but it's a small margin, and it's a Republican state, so we don't really know what's going to happen. Now we do know what happened, and Jack Conway's not going to be the next governor of Kentucky.
Well, let's stay with polling and move to that presidential race next year. New stuff coming out showing some shifting at the top in that crowded Republican field. What are we seeing?
Well, you know, we see different things if we look nationally than if we look in Iowa and New Hampshire. Nationally, we see, if you look, you know, for instance, at the Real Clear Politics average, for the first time since mid-July, somebody besides Donald Trump is leading that field. It's Ben Carson, who's been doing fairly well in the national polls, at least the ones that are conducted using live interviewers. Carson's leading in most of them. If you're looking in Iowa, Ted Cruz is moving up a little bit. And if you're looking in New Hampshire, Marco Rubio seems to be on the move. He's now in a clear third place to Trump and Carson.
How do we evaluate somebody like Rubio's chances of winning the nomination based on the numbers as they stand now?
I think that if you spoke with most people who have a job that's either mine, that is talking to me, or people similar to me, you would think that Marco Rubio probably has the best chance of winning the nomination. And it's not just because he's moving up in the polls in New Hampshire right now or moving up nationally. He's doing as well nationally as he did when he first announced. It's his high peak, high point. But if you look at his favorable ratings, they are much higher than, say, Donald Trump's or Jeb Bush's. The only one who beats him is Ben Carson. And more than that, we look at endorsements. Endorsements tell us a lot. That's what history tells us. And Rubio has gotten three senators to endorse him over the last week. That's more senators than have endorsed any other candidate except for Jeb Bush, who has three himself. But all of Rubio's are coming now. There's a real sense of momentum with him.
Yeah, and Jeb Bush polls bad news again and again. He's got the money. He's got, to the extent anybody has endorsements, he has those. What's happening?
I think that this is, you know, an example of you can lead a horse to water, but you can't force him to drink it. You know, Jeb Bush came into this race with a huge money advantage. He's had a lot of ads on the air in Iowa and New Hampshire, and the numbers just simply haven't moved. In fact, if they've moved anywhere, they've moved downward. His favorable ratings have dropped. He was only at 4% in the Quinnipiac poll that was taken nationally and released earlier today. And yes, he has the endorsements, but as you hinted at, he didn't have that many endorsements. It's just that nobody's really endorsed, and he had the most, but it's, you know, the biggest piece of a very small pie. Most Republicans have been standing on the sidelines waiting to choose a candidate, and right now, at least it seems that they're moving in Rubio's direction, but it's still very early. Even Rubio doesn't have that many endorsements yet.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538 about the top stories in national politics, big response to last week's Republican debate. Actually, during the debate, it was about the candidates versus the moderators. Is this, as Republican candidates and the Republican Party is saying, was this a biased panel of moderators?
Well, you know, this is something that Republican candidates have loved to do. You know, you remember in the 2012 South Carolina debate, you heard Newt Gingrich going after the moderators, saying that these are garbage questions and we should move on. We should have real substantive questions. And then he tried to do it again later. Mitt Romney cut him off and said, no, answer the question. But this is an old trick that's pulled out over and over again. If you look at the polls over time, you see Republicans are much less trusting of the national media than Democrats are. There was one poll that was conducted that showed only 20% of Republicans believe that the mainstream media was without bias. So, you know, someone like Ted Cruz, who was one of the first to bring it out, he knows what he's doing. Whether or not the questions were actually biased, I'll leave that up to your listeners to exactly say, but it was a very smart play in my book.
Talking about the media, they used to say never pick a fight with anyone who buys ink by the barrel. There's not that much ink bought these days. The media not loved. They don't have that clout that they used to.
They don't have that clout. And remember, most of the people who are watching and listening to these debates are people who either get their news from Fox or people who get their news from Rush Limbaugh. So if you're attacking somebody with CNBC in front of you, of their name, that they're a member of that news organization, which is connected with NBC News, that's just a very smart play if you're in a Republican primary and a Republican debate, because it's something that speaks across the Republican Party. Republican Party is divided on a lot of issues, but media bias is not one of them.
Well, let's turn to Congress, where Republicans have a new House Speaker. Now, of course, we have this budget deal, so we don't need to worry about shutdowns anymore. Uh-oh, wait, there's talk of maybe a shutdown standoff next month. So what's going on there?
Sure. You know, we know they have a deal. You know, how much money is going to be spent? I believe it's $1.1 trillion. It's just a matter of how it's spent and, you know, what riders are attached. Most of the conversations, if you read most of the stuff, you listen to what most of the Republican congressmen are saying, it's that there probably won't be a shutdown over things like Planned Parenthood because they want to give Paul Ryan a chance, give him a honeymoon period. But if there's one thing that we have learned over the past few months from this Republican caucus, is that they're unpredictable. I mean, Kevin McCarthy looked like he was going to be the next Speaker of the House one minute, and the next minute he wasn't. Of course, Paul Ryan is considerably more conservative, has considerably more credit with the different factions of the Republican caucus. So most people don't believe that there's going to be a shutdown, but it's something to keep an eye out on.
And Ryan's saying, hey, I'm going to run the show in a different way here, more openness, more debates, more amendments debated and added or rejected. Talk about his style here as Speaker, at least what he says he's going to do.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that he's going to do is he wants an advisory panel where he's going to have the different, you know, main caucuses of the Republican Party coming together, including the Freedom Caucus, which gave McCarthy and Boehner so many troubles. look, Ryan, as I said, just simply has much more credit on this. He's somebody who's, you know, has a much more conservative voting record. If you look at that record, at least at the ways that people like I, you know, sort of analyze them, it shows that he tends to be more on the anti-establishment wing than the establishment wing. So these people seem to be willing to give him a chance. You know, you listen to someone like Steve King out of Iowa. He is saying, look, we need to give him a honeymoon period. We need to give him a chance. And so right now, Ryan is talking the talk. Of course, there's a difference between talking the talk and walking the walk, and we're in that honeymoon period. You know, Boehner had a honeymoon period, too, and then that honeymoon period went adios amigos very, very quickly. So we won't be able to know exactly what's going on and for at least a few months.
Having that advisory council, having a couple of members of that Freedom Caucus at the table, do you think, regardless of the substance of what they're debating, do you think having them there early is going to maybe defuse potential conflicts?
Sure. I mean, this is like one of those things, you know, if you're part of a family, right, you can, what you really want is your voice to be heard and felt like that your parents are listening to you. And I guess the speaker is kind of like the ultimate parent, right? He runs the show, or she runs the show. And so, yes, I think that's one of the things that you're hearing from a lot of these Republicans in Congress is they're very happy that their voice is at least getting heard. Look, no one's going to get their way 100% of the time, but what they want is a fair shot. And right now they feel that Ryan is giving them that fair shot.
Harry, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time with the latest in national politics. Voters in Houston last night rejected an ordinance that would have established protections from discrimination for gay and transgender residents, as well as several other classes. The measure failed substantially, a vote of 61-39%. The battle over the referendum attracted attention from the White House, sports figures, celebrities. Opponents of the local law called it the bathroom ordinance, based on the fear that it would allow male sexual predators to enter women's bathrooms. Kimmy King is with us to talk about last night's vote, how it relates to the LGBT rights movement at large, including here in Wisconsin. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Well, I want to start by seeing what this ordinance was about, because you had one side, supporters of it, saying this is about discrimination, like in a lot of cities. You had the other side saying this is about letting men wander into women's bathrooms. What was this ordinance?
Well, this ordinance on its face really looked at providing equal access in a wide range of city employment, city services, city contracting, housing, public accommodations, and private employment. The sticking point are public accommodations, right? Because that involved the bathroom issue. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about the way in which this issue was transformed is something that happens quite common in American politics with these very highly contentious issues, that we have what's called issue framing going on. And so conservatives were able to reframe the issue and in essence say, if you pass what looks like on its face an equal protection ordinance, it will be used in these nefarious ways. And that was why there was such a backlash. And you see the 61%, which in political terms, that's a trouncing. Anytime you get above 60%, it's considered to having been defeated quite handily. So that's really what it boils down to, was taking that component, running it to its logical extreme, and then framing the issue for the voters in that way.
And a lot of political capital was spent by supporters, including the mayor of America's, what, fourth largest city?
Yes, and an openly lesbian mayor at that. And it's part of something that you see actually happening all over the country. You saw it in Colorado way back in the 90s, where urban centers have become much more liberal and democratic-leaning in their approach to politics, where the outlying suburbs and rural areas tend to be more conservative. And so this was the city of Houston attempting to put forward a referendum that in our city, in the liberal areas, this is how we want to proceed, and there was backlash as a result. And so Parker had taken on this cause. She's not eligible to run for mayor again because of term limits. And so as a result, this has been an issue that's really been going on there for about 9 months. And quite honestly, it's going to be an issue that you're going to see played out across the country as we continue to debate this issue about LGBT rights.
Now, these issues are going on all over the country, as you say. Gay marriage, same-sex marriage, in a lot of ways has been resolved. We're just talking about subsidiary things like, you know, who you can sell a cake to or refuse service to. The issue here seemed to be centered around transgender residents and their public access rights. Is that the frontier now, the T in LGBT?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see. Keep in mind that the federal government has recently raised the issue out of the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, which has ordered a taxpayer-funded school district to allow a male transgender student who dresses like a girl and otherwise identifies as female to use the shower. And they've said that basically you have 2 weeks to comply or you can lose federal monies. And so there is a battle going on with the federal government and the state governments, and now you're going to see city and county governments get involved as well. I don't know that this will become the poster child for where the debate goes. Most people looking at this issue say the real concern is about religious liberty exemptions. Will people, if you, based on your sincere religious beliefs, are opposed to LGBT rights, will a church have to perform gay marriages? I think those are going to be the issues that tend to come up to the top. This one is just very interesting because there was so much attention on the national stage about it.
We are looking at one of yesterday's election results from across the nation. This one in the city of Houston on a discrimination measure in that city, an ordinance. It was rejected overwhelmingly by voters. Kimmy King is with us from the University of North Texas. Will we see battles like this with or without the bathroom issue over discrimination ordinances in other cities, maybe at the state level too, Kimmy?
Yes, you will, and you're going to see a continuation of issues. It's not going to be, you know, the debate shifts from marriage equality or same-sex marriage, depending on your perspective, to talking about issues like custody, right? Issues of divorce will start to come into play, how you divide up property. These sorts of issues in familial relations are, I think, going to be the issues that you see much more happening. But you're also seeing in general, I think it's interesting because I have to point out the Ohio case, right, where the marijuana initiative went down because it was thought that there were special interests there that were going to benefit more from the legalization of marijuana. And it's mobilizing the public on different issues to get them to turn out in these initiative proposals. So you're actually seeing more civic engagement. And as we engage the larger community, whether it's urban or rural, you're going to get these kinds of battles because the different interest groups are going to portray them in certain ways. And so certainly right now the issue of bathrooms is all up in everybody's face, but I guarantee you in another week it'll be something else.
Now, speaking of issue groups and outside interests, was a lot of money coming into this locally in Houston and from around the country?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things about patchwork legislation, I'm just going to call it that, where you go in and you try to get little bites of the apple in different places to get your policy changes. One of the reasons behind why that can be difficult is because it gets very expensive. One of the concerns over marriage equality was the fact that there was all kinds of litigation going on all over the country at state and at federal level. So when the Supreme Court came in and in essence created this kind of national uniformity, it ended the debate and much of the fighting about it. It's now just going to shift out in different ways.
Now, speaking of patchwork legislation, something different for us here in Wisconsin, we don't generally have this referendum process. We have constitutional amendments that need to be approved by voters. You know, we have local school referenda and advisory referenda. That's it. So how does having those binding referenda in place affect politics in a city or a state?
Well, one of the things about it is that in most situations, you have to go out and you have to get a number of signatures. You may or may not have to get, like, the city council or the state legislature to approve it to go on the ballot. But then keep in mind, when the voters come in, they can just shift it, right? And they can throw a referendum back on the ballot to try to change the situation. You know, I think one of the things that'll be really interesting is the extent to which we start thinking outside the box. So I'm going to put forward something to you about my home institution, which is the University of North Texas, and that is we had an issue about LGBT rights a few years ago, and bathrooms specifically. And what we did, rather than get into a huge battle over it, was we stepped back and we said, let's look at the coalitions involved here. And when we looked at it, we discovered that there were actually single mothers with children that didn't really want to take their little boys into women's bathrooms. And we saw there were fathers with little girls who they didn't want to just send into a women's bathroom. And so we strategically looked across the campus and we created what we're calling family bathrooms. And those, in essence, created a space for single dads, for single moms, for transgendered persons, and in general for the public that doesn't feel comfortable about public bathrooms, provided them with a private space. We ended that debate on this campus by just creating a few strategically placed family bathrooms. We brought together broad coalitions of people, and we solved the problem.
Very briefly, Kimmy, do you think there are going to be a lot of contentious issues that we can kind of work around in that way?
I think the bathroom issue is a safe cause, to be honest with you. I think the religious liberty issue will have to be resolved next. And the role that churches and persons with sincere beliefs have regarding LGBT issues, that's going to be next up on the docket. That's going to be the next one that you see all of the fights about. So watch for those first.
Kimmy, thanks as always.
You betcha.
That's Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, looking at yesterday's vote in Houston on an anti-discrimination ordinance. The global economy can be hard to understand and follow, but even if we don't follow every single twist and turn, there are concrete effects being felt right here in the Badger State. Joining us now to talk about some of those direct and indirect impacts of the global economy is Rick Barrett. He covers manufacturing, telecom, and agriculture for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Rick, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello, Rob.
Well, in a recent piece, you talked about a global slump, especially in manufacturing, having an effect here on factories in Wisconsin. How are we feeling that here?
Well, I think you could say there are a lot of changes that have gone on in manufacturing recently. It's not all bad. I mean, there are some companies that are doing very well. You know, orders are up. You know, sales are good. They're looking for help, and That sort of thing. You can say it depends on what sort of sector you're into. There are other companies where it's not that way at all. And what we've seen is a slowdown in the global environment for mining equipment, for all kinds of products that are exported from Wisconsin. And that's hit this area pretty hard.
So what kind of companies are we talking about in the state that are feeling the pinch from, as you say, industries like mining, and I think oil drilling is one of them, all of China in a slump? What kind of factories, what kind of businesses here in the state are feeling a pinch from that downside?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you can point to the mining equipment companies in Milwaukee as the first example. I mean, Caterpillar and Joy Global are two of the largest industrial employers in the area. And just those two alone, they've cut hundreds and hundreds of jobs. And it's not just Joy Global and Caterpillar. It's all the companies that supply them. And there are dozens of companies that supply them in Wisconsin. And they're all feeling it too.
And there was some talk of that kind of company in that region maybe benefiting from iron mining in northern Wisconsin that, at least at present, is off the table. But these are companies that really are not supplying a state or a region or a country. They are really dependent on what's going on all over the world, aren't they?
Yeah, that's correct, Rob. I mean, these are companies that, you could say almost all of their business is outside of Wisconsin.
And how about the upside? You said it's not all gloom and doom. What factories are seeing a good news from the global economy?
I think you could say that companies that are into the automotive sector, if they're tied with the right automaker, they have the right contract, they're on the right vehicle build, they're doing very well right now.
Talking to Rick Barrett from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about how Wisconsin is feeling the impact, for better and in some cases for worse, from what's going on in the global economy. Now, how important is manufacturing here in Wisconsin, say, compared to some of our neighbors or other states around the country?
Manufacturing is huge in Wisconsin. I think we're second probably only to Indiana in terms of the impact of manufacturing and employment in the economy here.
Given that these things are all on the world stage, is there really much in the state's toolkit on a policy level to help companies that are feeling this pinch?
It's a good question, but I think, and there are always things that are policy driven, but so much of this is outside of Wisconsin, whether it's on a national or an international basis. It could be, you know, slower growth in China, it's weak exports to Europe, it is a strong U.S. dollar that's made us less competitive overseas. It's oil and gas, it's mining. These are things that are outside of our state, frankly.
So you looked at some of the businesses feeling the downside of a slump in China and a slump in global oil and mining. How are they trying to weather the storm? What kinds of things are they doing to, you know, avoid going out of business?
They're cutting costs. They're pulling back. Caterpillar and Joy Global, as I mentioned, I mean, those are two examples where they've got hundreds of jobs. Caterpillar especially is closing plants all over the U.S.
And you talk to a handful of local economic experts from around the state. Do they see grounds for optimism for industries like that in the state? Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but in the next 5-10 years.
It's a good question. I mean, manufacturing has always been very cyclical. Oil and gas, mining, you name the sector. There are good times and there are bad times. And unfortunately, this has been a rather extended down period for some of our manufacturers, and they're really feeling it now.
I wonder about diversity, because when you think about a place like Detroit, doing better, a little better now, but it was all its eggs were in that automobile basket. And when that went down, the whole region was in big trouble. Do we have a more diverse manufacturing base in Wisconsin?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We're much more diverse than Michigan is.
How so? And why is that?
I think just historically, Wisconsin has been diverse, whether it's agricultural equipment or whether it's all kinds of consumer-type products. We're more diverse than Detroit, than Michigan overall is.
Is there room for state economic developers, whether we're talking about the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation or maybe city or regional planners, to try to promote more diversity to try to help areas that are affected by this global manufacturing downturn?
I think that's one of the things they focused on. I mean, they realize that diversity in our economy is very important. Again, though, there's only so much that state policymakers can do, because these are marketplace type issues.
You refer in your piece to the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce's Business Outlook Survey. As we wrap up, what is the tone? Are we seeing optimism, pessimism, or a mix from businesses in that area?
I think the tone is very cautious at this point. I mean, if you look at profit expectations, they've weakened in each of the past two quarters. If you look at the job gains, they're consistent, but they're not spectacular. There are non-manufacturers are more likely to forecast job gains than manufacturers. So in the service sector, there's still some growth out there.
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Rick Barrett. He covers manufacturing, telecom, and agriculture over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about the impact of global economic woes on industry here in Wisconsin. This past summer, we debuted a weekly music series called Setlist, where we invited Wisconsin artists into our WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances. Happy to announce we'll be running a second season of Setlist starting next summer. Veronica Ricker checked in with series co-producers Brad Kohlberg and Carl Christensen for a preview of what we can expect in the upcoming season this summer.
Well, let's talk about Setlist. How did the idea start for this series that you decided to call Setlist?
I'm a big music fan, and uh, I I just really wanted to work with bands. We have this nice big studio here. We have a bunch of gear, these great old vintage mics, etc. And I thought it would be fun. And I saw, you know, around the public radio landscape, other stations and organizations starting to have some success dealing with contemporary music. And I just thought that it would be fun for us here at WPR to give it a try.
So these bands didn't just phone it in, you know, literally. You had the bands. We hosted them in the studio. What was that like for you?
It was great. I mean, there's an audio and a video component to these. So we were shooting, you know, video of them as well. So we'd have them in Buck Studio, which is this, if you've never seen it, this pretty large old school kind of studio. It always reminds me of like a Hollywood soundstage or something with the big boom mics and the parquet floor. And it's a really cool place to
the blue velvet curtains.
Yes, exactly. And so it's a really cool place to set up a band or an artist and capture a really cool performance.
Well, let's talk about some of the first series, the inaugural series of Setlist. What were some of your favorites, Carl?
There were so many good ones. My favorite, if I had to choose one, J.E. Sundy. He is a singer-songwriter, and he used to live in Eau Claire and played with the band back in the day called the Daredevil Christopher Wright. And but now he's doing a solo thing, pretty folky, and just a very pure, beautiful voice. It struck me when he just was warming up, just how great his voice sounded. And timing-wise, when we recorded that session, I had just recently had a baby. So it worked out really well for me, his lyrics. There was just a lot of hope to what he was saying, and it struck me as it was just perfect timing for me to hear that guy. So it's beautiful music.
So with that, let's take a listen.
Easy kid, take it easy kid. No, I've never done the drugs that you did. I imagine they would go right to my head. All our jackets piled upon the bed, and I'd sleep all the way back home. Headlights are bright on my face, but the sun doesn't melt away. We woke to
J.E. Sundy there from last session set list. That's a track called Easy Kid. And Brad, I'm going to toss you this question too. What stuck out to you last session of set list?
Yeah, I love J.E. Sundy. I thought that everyone that we had in did a great job. They were really professional, even with the tight focus on local music here in Wisconsin. One of the ones that really stuck out to me was a band from Madison called Dolores. And we had Dolores in pretty early on in our production schedule. They're actually the first full band to show up. We'd done a couple of folkier artists prior to that. But what was so fun for me about Dolores was that they were a full-on rock band, and it's the first time I'd ever dealt with that in Buck Studio. So I had some nerves going into it, wondering if a full band was really going to, wondering if we were going to be able to pull it off, you know, because it's pretty unlike what typically happens in that room. And they came in and they were really laid back. They had a lot of fun. They were joking the whole time, and they played just impeccably. I thought they really nailed it.
All right, if you think it's not that bad, I encourage you to think about it. Do it alone. If you think it's not that bad, I encourage you to think about it. Do it alone.
Dolores there, and that's a track called Hear You Walking. That's from last season of Setlist. And you guys asked me about one of my favorites, and this is a guy you booked for me I hadn't heard of. His name is Milo. Carl, right. Tell us a little bit about Milo.
Milo, yeah, he's a rapper from Milwaukee, and he it was cool. He came in with two other guys with him, and they brought just some samplers, some, you know, some gear and headphones, and they set up, and they did their quick sound check, you know, got it all dialed in really, really nicely. Brad, good job on that.
Hey, thanks.
And then, you know, typically when we have a artist in, they usually, you know, sound check's done, and we're like, hey, let's, you guys have got about an hour until we actually have to tape this thing. So, you know, feel free to grab lunch or whatever. These guys didn't want to do that. They just hung around and just kept jamming on their samplers and just, like, writing new music. And they were just, it struck me how excited they were to just play music for the sake of playing music. So they just kept creating right there. It was really cool. They were just writing new songs.
Wow, I didn't even come in for that part because I didn't come in until later.
Yeah, they were just putting together a new album or something. I don't know. It was really cool. But not just the music, though. The interview Mila did was, it was one of my favorites. It was, he had a lot of great stuff to say. It was really cool. And there's I think we have a clip here for that.
Such an extreme paranoia takes over me when I'm writing.
Wait, what kind of paranoia?
You know, a lot of the ideas in my music are very fragile, or maybe I don't have the best language to say them. Maybe there is no best language to even say them. And so I'm just so worried about putting those ideas in the hands of clumsy thinkers. There's a song my friend Alex Safariao, who played with me, he and I have a song from my first mixtape that, I don't know, the idea was, what if two guys who were in love with each other wrote a rap song about one another and then rapped it to one another? And then, you know, we just thought that was interesting. And so we did that. And then we put it out, and, you know, just clumsy thinkers, people who can't pause a reaction. I guess that's what I mean, reactionary. Like, it's incredibly rare now for people to just sit and digest a thing and just not have an opinion. You know, just, I need to take some time, because it's like, it takes a long time to make a song or an album or whatever.
Well, honestly, who could say? I remember the art museum where Mike Eagle found Dubuffet. I remember Meredith blessing me with Jean Genet and blowing my old life kisses bombs away. I remember packing an apartment into three bags and driving across God's kneecaps to Lord knows where. I'm more bored than scared. How I learned to portion the orphan share or be the burden bearer. Working titles of my autobiography. I'm probably not the rapper for you. Listen to the method.
Some music and an interview with the artist Mila from Milwaukee as we talk about last season's set list with co-producers Brad Kohlberg and Carl Christensen. And so that's last season. We're all excited because we're getting started rolling on next season. And Brad, what do we have to look forward to?
Quite a bit. We're still going to keep a pretty tight focus on Wisconsin. I think, you know, the 10 episodes from last summer didn't do our state justice in the music scene. So there's going to be a lot more from Wisconsin, but we're also going to open it up a little bit and look at the region a little bit. You know, huge music scenes, really diverse in Minneapolis and Chicago. So there's going to be a regional element to it also. Someone in particular that I've been listening to quite a bit lately, he actually grew up in Chippewa Falls. His name is Phil Cook. He's lived for about the last 10 years in North Carolina, Raleigh-Durham. And he just put out a solo album. It's called Southland Mission. And it's just, it's fantastic. He's definitely a hometown boy made good. There are elements of folk and rock, soul, gospel, bluegrass. I mean, it just runs the gamut, often all within the same song. And I'm a big fan.
Phil Cook, track 1922, someone we're going to look forward to on the next set list, which is coming up. That was your pick, Brad. Carl, Who are you looking forward to?
Well, I was surprised a couple weeks ago. I'd never, I guess I had heard of this band, but I'd never seen them before. They're called Midnight Reruns, and they're another Milwaukee band. And I just happened to go to a local bar a couple weeks ago in Madison called Mickey's, which has always has a lot of good music there. And I just saw these guys play, and they just completely blew me away. Just kind of jangly power pop kind of actually their new album they put out, the bassist from The Replacements, Tommy Stinson, actually produced it. But yeah, they kind of have that sound, and they have kind of these like soaring dueling lead guitar lines going on a lot. So kind of like Thin Lizzy sound, but just really a really cool high energy band. I'm excited to, if they agree, come on in and do a set.
All right. So here's a band we'll hopefully hear, Midnight Reruns. Brad, thanks a lot for coming on and talking set list.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
That was Veronica talking to Brad Kohlberg and Carl Christensen, co-producers of Setlist here on WPR. You can see and hear the performances and interviews from last summer's Setlist music series. Head over to WPR.org/setlist. The website will be continually updated with new content until a new series returns next summer. The World Series is over, but there's still some big news in the world of baseball. Now, if you're a Brewers fan, nothing is going to get you pumped up like a Brewers home run, right? Well, how about that home run called on the radio by Mr. Baseball, Bob Uecker?
Way back! Get up! Get out of here! Gone for Maldonado! He just hit a walk-off out of here, and this one is over!
And so you've probably asked yourself, what if I could wake up every day to the inspiring words of Bob Uecker? Well, now you can, or you can starting July 10th of next year. Today, the Brewers announced an in-stadium giveaway for that day. It's the Talking Bob Uecker Alarm Clock. So you can wake up to the inspiring words, this is according to the press release, get up, get up, get out of bed. I had my non-talking Bob Uecker bobblehead with me in my office earlier. I asked him if this alarm clock is a good idea. Bobblehead Uecker says yes. Yes, he is all for it. So plan on waking up with get up, get out of bed late next summer.